My name's Tim Brill, Director of Corporate Communications and Investor Relations at Microfocus, and I'd like to welcome you to Microfocus's interim results presentation for the 6 months to the end of October 2016. I'm delighted to be joined by Kevin Loosemore, Executive Chairman, Mike Phillips, CFO, Stephen Murdoch, Chief Executive of the Microfocus portfolio, and Niels Brachmann, CEO of the SUSE portfolio. You hopefully have all had a chance to look at the results statement issued just after 7 this morning. You've got copies of that and the presentation for today on your chairs. This presentation is being recorded. An audio cast will be posted onto our IR pages of our website by midday today, so anybody who wants to go back to that is able to do so. We will keep this to the usual format, so look for us to talk to, hopefully, up to 40 minutes, and then we'll leave ourselves 20 minutes for Q&A. If I could ask you to bear with us as we get to the Q&A, keep it to one question each, but I will come back and try and compare that as we reach that point. But we'll run through, in a moment I'll hand over to Stephen Murdoch, who after a group overview will take you through the highlights for the Microfocus portfolio. Niels will do the same for the SUSE portfolio before Mike runs through the numbers. And then Kevin will round off with a group summary and also touch on clearly a significant announcement during the 6 months around the proposed HPE transaction. So with that, Stephen, if I could ask you to come to the front and we'll get going.
Thank you, Tim. Good morning, everyone. We're very pleased with this set of results. Revenue up 1.2%. We're reconfirming the full year guidance of flat to minus 2%. Continued growth in EBITDA, 6.2% in the period, and our disciplined approach to M&A is something that has again continued throughout the first half. We actually completed three transactions, with the Serena deal completing on the 2nd of May, then two much smaller deals, one with a company called Guava Inc., which is in the collaboration and networking space, and the second in the SUSE space with the company, the assets and people and talent from a company called OpenAttic. We've also announced two transactions, obviously the major deal with HPE, but then secondly, a partnership where we take their assets around their cloud infrastructure and into the SUSE business. Total shareholder return strategy continues, and you can see the dividend is consistent with our twice-covered policy. If I take you through now a little more on the specific to the Microfocus portfolio, then I would describe the half as a continued progress against the strategy of running this as a portfolio and managing at a granular level each individual product and each individual line of the P&L. So first and foremost, we're on track against the financial commitments made. The portfolio strategy continues to give encouraging signs of yielding from the product level investments that we've made against this vision, this ambition of customer-driven innovation, where we really concentrate and focus our efforts back onto exactly what the customer base that we have wants and expects and needs from the portfolio, in essence helping them solve real problems today. The Serena integration is on track, and the business plan for that acquisition is also on track. We completed Guava. Guava is a small company, but they provide really innovative technology in the collaboration and networking space, which we believe will enable us to open up very different dialogues with the customer base in that portfolio. And we've already seen some of the early signs of cross-sell from that to date. We do the boring things really well. We keep executing and looking for every single way we can to improve the underlying business operations. I'll take you through a little more of that in a moment. And we've begun the work to re-engineer the go-to-market organization. Clearly, we're doing that in driving efficiency of our existing business, but we're also doing it with a lens on the HPE transaction and assuming what we need to get done in advance of that. In terms of engagement and resourcing, I would describe where we're at against HPE as on track. Yeah. There's good levels of engagement, and we've got the right people over the over the opportunity. This is the P&L. You can see that revenues were down 3.6%, which is an improvement from the trend we left last year. EBITDA at the underlying adjusted level up 3.1%, and a 320 basis point improvement on the margin. Taking a little bit more at the portfolio levels, and the summary here is that we're very strong CDMS performance, and you might look at the host connectivity line and say a relatively weak performance. But last year, these two things were reversed. We had a weak COBOL performance. We had a very good host connectivity performance. And the reality is that's how our model works. We manage these things for the long term. We have pieces that are occasionally up. We have pieces that are occasionally down. I'm no less excited about the COBOL numbers than I am, unhappy about the host connectivity numbers. And, we will manage them and balance them out over the longer term. The two portfolios at the bottom, development IT and ITOM, and collaboration and networking, declined as we expected. And we're now also beginning to see some of the efforts in the product repositioning and realignment hopefully beginning to bear some fruit in there. And IAS was broadly flat if you strip out the consulting revenues, which are there as an enabler of license rather than a revenue line in and of itself. I mentioned previously that this portfolio, we typically are oriented towards large-scale, heavy-lifting re-engineering projects in the customer. By the very definition, they're lumpy and they're difficult to predict timing-wise. So our efforts have been on repositioning the portfolio to the more sustainable areas of growth in that market, which are typically smaller, more governance-led projects. And again, good progress in getting that done. This just gives you a flavor at the regional level. And again, points of real strength, points that need to get improved. Continued stability and progress in North America. Really strong Asia-Pacific Japan performance. Mixed performance in international. Pleased with execution in the UK and France. Lots more to do in Brazil, just to give you a flavor for where we're at. If we put this into the context of how do we plan for the integration of businesses we buy, and how do we fit those into an overall framework that underpins our execution? Well, we really look at it in these five layers. First and foremost, we focus on earning the right to do what's underneath. So that means delivering the financial plan. That's underpinned by the portfolio model at the product level, where we try and reorient all of our investments to this idea of helping customers solve real problems today, which we call customer-driven innovation. Underpinning that, we look to simplify the processes, improve the underlying data quality, the analytics and the reporting, each line in the P&L. And then we have the reshaping or the re-engineering of the business for the future. And the simplest way to think about this at the moment is the go-to-market re-engineering is underway. The acquisition work is progressing well, and we're beginning to codify some of our learnings into playbooks so that we're more repeatable and capable of driving that. This level continues apace, but really in the simplified platform for growth, in essence, we're reshaping that work to be done in the context of the HPE transaction. So that means, for example, our systems plan or project to standardize systems is now being rephased to be done with the lens of the combined organization. Okay, so everything else continues apace. The simplified platform for growth is being rephased and replanned in the context of HPE. If I take you through the just that simplification layer and give you a few examples, what you see here is at the completion of the TAG acquisition. So we had 4,177 people in Micro Focus, 470 in SUSE. And you can fast forward to today, you see a 15% reduction in the Micro Focus resources and a 65% increase in the SUSE resources. We're relentless in rationalizing spend that doesn't add value. So you can see an example there of taking 147 locations down to 97. Locations. But contrary to what you might read in some reports, we haven't cut products. We don't kill products. It's actually the antithesis of what you should do in a mature infrastructure software space. What we do, for example, where we have overlapping products, is we look to try and accomplish best of both. So these companies typically solve the same type of business problem, but they grew up competing with each other. Therefore, they developed an edge that was unique to them, a capability that was unique to them. And the real secret sauce is if you can figure out how to take that capability that was unique and make it available to both customer bases. So in the host connectivity space, we took the security capabilities out of Reflection and put them into the Rumba product. Reflection came from Tag, Rumba was Micro Focus. In the development and ITOM space, we took the change management capability out of StarTeam, which was a Micro Focus product. And we're now putting that into the Serena capability, whereas Serena was particularly strong in a different area called code review. And we're putting that into the StarTeam product through an integration framework. So that's what we try to do in the product base. We've changed the cadence of release from quite a traditional 12 to 24 month waterfall type process in Tag to a more agile 6 to 12 months release cadence now, which then allows us to get into the product faster what the customer wants to see. In the collaboration and networking space, a great example of getting that done was creating an ideas portal where the customers could actually vote on what they wanted to see in the next release. We got the first three priorities into the next release for that customer base. And as a direct result of that, we had a very substantial win back from a competitive product in our international business last year. Similarly, we believe that you should be in control of your own destiny in strategic areas of your product portfolio. So whereas the Tag organization had a reliance on OEM, so third-party software at the core of the IAS portfolio, we've now, through a combination of acquisition and increased investment in the internally, organically, we've now written out of the product those two third-party dependencies, which clearly positions us better for the for the longer term. So just some examples of that simplification layer and how we get after each line in the P&L systematically. Looking forward, boringly, this is exactly the same as we said the last time, so we'll commit and continue to be committed to delivering the financial plan. The strategy around the management of the portfolio at the product level and a very granular level continues. We're prioritizing the work on go-to-market and continuing to try to simplify areas of our core business because that's the right thing to do for the business today, but also the right thing to position us for life post-completion of the HPE transaction. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Niels.
Thank you. Clickers on that?
Yes.
Okay. So good morning, everyone. So it will be my pleasure now to take you through the results of the SUSE business for the first half of fiscal year 17. I'll go straight to the first slide, which is a summary slide, and gives you all the necessary key performance indicators of the SUSE business for the first half of the year. So the first half of the year was a successful period for SUSE, as you can see from the numbers. So we're very pleased about the results. All the relevant key performance indicators show significant growth. Revenue grew at a rate of 23.3%, so we were very pleased about that revenue growth that we saw. Deferred revenue balance, we also point out to you, that's all the revenue that we have generated, but we could not recognize, that we put on the deferred revenue bank, is sitting now at $335.2 million and also showed growth of 21.8%. That's important because that's the revenue that we will be able to recognize in future periods. So ultimately, that is the foundation that we are laying for future growth in future periods. So an important number to track as well. We also have information about the billings metrics, not just revenue, also billings metrics. Total contract value is basically a metric where we count all the subscription contracts that we sell and invoice with the full contract length. So that includes multi-year elements. And that number actually grew at 20.3% for the first 6 months of the fiscal year. And then annual contract value is also billings metric, and there we count only the first 12 months of each contract that we sell. That means we really exclude the multi-year elements, so it's net of any multi-year elements, and that number grew at a rate of 16.3%. So while we did grow the business, at the same time we actually maintained profitability, a very healthy profitability. We sometimes call it market-leading profitability for an open-source business, that that serves the infrastructure software needs of enterprise customers. You will see here that the adjusted underlying EBITDA sits at $53.2 million. That's an increase of 25.2% compared to the previous period. The profit margin for the business currently sits at 36.3%. So that's 1% point more than we reported last time. So overall, the business is very profitable at the same time as we grow, and that means we are delivering on our growth chart to produce repeatable and profitable growth. Some information about progress and expansion of the business beyond numbers. So Stephen also alluded to that. We continue to invest into the business, into headcount, different functional areas and different geographies as well. And the headcount for the last 6 months grew at a rate of plus 21%. So we continue to invest heavily to build a foundation to expand this business and position it for ongoing and future growth. We also completed our first technology acquisition, SUSE did, with the support of Micro Focus. In fact, it's only possible since we are now part of the Micro Focus group. OpenAttic software and engineering talent. It provides a storage management capability, so that's a technology that we need to strengthen our SUSE Enterprise storage product, which now will be taken to market with improved management capabilities, and that's exactly something that enterprise customers tell us that they need. And then we also signed a definitive agreement with HPE to acquire from HPE their OpenStack infrastructure as a service assets and also their Cloud Foundry platform as a service assets. Assets means in this case technology and also the engineering talent that develops those solutions. Definitive agreement signed. We are targeting a completion date of Q1 calendar year of next year. So these are two very interesting activities that we are doing here, because for the first time, we are not just relying on organic growth in the SUSE business, but we are really also using the tool of technology acquisitions to further accelerate the growth and increase the agility of the SUSE business. We are also investing in those two areas, in solution areas where our enterprise customers and alliance partners are requesting from us that we bring the next wave of relevant open source technology to our customers. So we are investing in generating those new solutions and taking them to market. And that means we are actually, once all of those resources on board, we are increasing our expense portfolio, the expense that SUSE carries, and that will have a little bit of an impact on the profit contribution margin that we carry forward. So I want to point that out to you. And then on top of that, we also extend our presence and contribution in key open source projects. We are an open source business. We are depending on open source innovation. And for that reason, we invest into the open source communities. We contribute. We make sure that we increase our presence. We make sure that we can influence the technology direction of those innovation groups. And we also increase our presence to make sure that we can effectively represent the requirements of our enterprise customers and our alliance partners that they have for those open source communities. Okay, so that's a very important thing. And we continue to invest in those areas. I'll give you a specific example. We just announced that we will be a platinum member of the Cloud Foundry Foundation, Cloud Foundry Platform as a Service. So it makes sense because it supports our acquisition. And we will also take a board seat in the Cloud Foundry Foundation to be right at power when it is about defining the future of this Cloud Foundry project. Some additional information, the regional revenue performance, you see that all the major geos actually did show significant growth in the period until now, so we are very pleased with that. I wanted, you see the percentage growth numbers on the right column on the screen. I want to point out this exceptional, extraordinary performance that you see in the international region. The revenue growth was 29.2%. So it is exceptional to some degree, because many things came together and worked in our favor, really like a perfect positive storm for us in international in the first half of the year. There was a very healthy large deal momentum. We had a couple of nice true-up orders coming from the market. some of those routes to market with a bigger revenue yield, like IHV and public cloud performed well in international, and that all contributed to the extraordinary strong growth in international, both on revenue and on billings, as you will see on the next slide. And that drove, to a certain degree, also the performance of SUSE globally. I want to point out to you that I think it's exceptional. The growth will continue to be healthy, but it will not be at that level going forward in international. So don't think that 29 is the new norm for international for that reason. Also, 23%, I believe, is not the new norm for SUSE going forward revenue growth-wise. Okay. A couple of words about performance in the regions from a billings perspective, total contract value and annual contract value. I introduced those metrics to you. North America had an okay performance. We call it solid, let's say an okay performance. TCV growth at almost 1%. ACV growth growing by 5.5%. Actually, what happened in North America is towards the end of the half year, we had a couple of timing issues where some of the larger renewal transactions, including some substantial new contract elements, did not close. They got delayed, and they will close in Q3 of the fiscal year. If they would have closed, because they have not disappeared, then the performance in North America would have been more solid. International, very strong. I gave you the reasons already for that. And then APJ, let's quickly talk about that. APJ had a very, very good performance, not just on the revenue side, but also on the billing side as well. We are constantly working on agreeing, negotiating new contracts with alliance partners, IHV alliance partners that have global relevance. We are also engaging in global relationship with public cloud service providers. And the APJ sales team is now starting to leverage those global agreements also locally in Asia Pacific and Japan, and that drives some of the growth. In addition to that, some of you might recall that at the beginning of this fiscal year, we announced that we will invest into APJ and go to market there with a fully dedicated SUSE specialized sales force that is also completely aligned with the SUSE business unit. At the end of the day, this approach opens new opportunities for us in the APJ market, and we see some of that in the bookings results. Okay. ACV by route to market. So how do our solutions or products flow to market? Here we'll see that three of the four routes show significant growth. Indirect, the global service partner route, which would be all the IHVs, like an HPE, like a Fujitsu, like a Dell, like an IBM are included there. And also the OEM route showed significant growth. That is a positive thing because we have a clear commitment to an indirect sales strategy. We invest heavily to support the indirect channels, both our global service providers as well as the indirect channel on top of that. So that's by design. What is maybe remarkable is that, and maybe to some degree disturbing, that you see a little bit of a decline in the direct route. But again, I would not overanalyze that one because we are working a push-pull model in sales. That means our salespeople are out there engaging with a large enterprise customers, position our solutions, take them through the sales cycle, help to negotiate the solutions and close. And then in some cases, they buy directly from us. In some cases, actually, they decide to procure with their global service provider, sometimes together with hardware. And that's exactly what happened in the last half year. We saw a couple of customers that we take care directly, where we are in contact with them, but they decide to route their solutions when they made a decision through the global service providers, and that leads to the decline in the direct sales route. But believe me, at the end of the day, this route to market is performing well for us and will continue to contribute to our growth because it's influencing and designing deals and then pulling them through the channel or with the help of the channel. Alliance and GSP relationships, like I said, very important part of our business. Strong growth since many years, and for that reason, we continue to engage in activities to deepen and broaden our relationship in that areas. Three examples. One is an existing IHV partner, Fujitsu, an existing OEM, who now takes the partnership with SUSE to the next level. Basically, in addition to Linux, we are now working with them also on hybrid cloud solutions or solutions for the hybrid cloud, mission critical extensions for enterprise Linux. We are taking to market with them as well. And we also collaborate around the development and go to market for future solutions like container, Linux container, platform as a service solutions, and micro OS technologies. So a classical example where we take an existing partnership, broaden it, take it to the next level, and for that reason make it more productive, both around technology collaboration, but also around go-to-market collaboration. Okay. The other example is about a small open source business that is out there, open source software business, that has a neat software around enterprise IT automation. So we collaborate with that open source business, integrate their open source technology into our solution, and strengthen SUSE Manager, which is our Linux management solution, through this collaboration. And then the third one might be a surprise. MyRent is actually a competitor of SUSE. They also have an OpenStack infrastructure as a service solution, a pure play open stack vendor in the marketplace. Also, their solution needs to run on an operating system. And we actually agreed with them in a partnership to provide enterprise Linux support from SUSE for their customers that choose to run their private cloud solution in the enterprise. And they pay us a royalty for the enterprise Linux support that they get from us. Right? So a clear collaboration case with a competitor in the market. We do that from time to time, and it's beneficial for everybody, for us, for our competitors as well, but certainly also for the enterprise customer that we serve. Second half outlook, that's really my last slide. So we continue to perform against our charter. Sustainable means repeatable, profitable revenue growth. I think it's fair to say that we will deliver on our revenue, TCV, ACV, and also profit targets also in the second half of the year. And that also means that for the full year, we continue also to grow the deferred revenue balance. Remember, I said initially at my first slide, that's an important metric, because if that continues to grow, we already now lay the foundation for a certain pool of revenue that we will pick up in fiscal year 18 as a solid foundation for ongoing revenue growth. So that will be an area of emphasis for us. Also, we will have to integrate the OpenATIC and HPE assets. OpenATIC, that's actually, let's say, completed already. HPE assets, we can only start to integrate once the deal completes, which is targeted for Q1 calendar year 2017. And then, probably no surprise, the last bullet point, yes, we will continue to put emphasis on optimizing our strategic partnerships, both in the area of technology collaboration to strengthen our solution, but certainly also in the area of go-to-market partnership to make sure that we just sell more and increase revenue for the business. Okay. And that's really it, a little bit of green on the screen. And like always, I can't stop doing it. And then I hand over to Mike Phillips. Thanks. Clicker.
Good morning, everybody. We've got within the pack the usual slides. Some of them we've pushed back to the appendix so that you've got them, but all the trend charts by portfolio you will have, so you've got that information as usual. But up front, I've tried to scale this down just so we focus on the key elements of the results and financial results. These are the as reported numbers. So this is really demonstrating the increase in scale as a result of the Serena acquisition that we completed on the first day of the half year. You can see that the underlying adjusted EBITDA number is up on a reported basis by 20%. The adjusted earnings per share are up by about 20%, so that is flowing through. And the dividend is up by 75% as we implement for the first time for the interim dividend, the full year policy that we put back in place, dividends being twice covered by the adjusted diluted earnings of the business. so key highlights there as we then move to pro forma constant currency. So this is taking into account the Serena numbers as they reported in their financial year to 31st of January. So taking their first 6 months, adding it to our first 6 months, adjusting for the currency, you get a 1.2% improvement in revenues. You get a 6.2% improvement in the underlying adjusted EBITDA. And that's the key component you'll recall for our management incentive around corporate bonus and corporate bonus for staff is the improvement in that number. Growth in adjusted earnings per share, they reflect just the benefit that's come through to shareholders, which is a 20.5% improvement. And then the details then on the Serena transaction, which if you look at our net debt as reported at the end of April, it's just over, just under 1.1 billion. But actually, we put all of the cash in place to actually complete on the 2nd of May. So taking into account those cash flows, you end up at 1.625 at the end of April, compared to the 1.613 that we find ourselves in at the end of October. First half, generally, we don't see much change in the net debt, but clearly the cash generation of this business is key. And we've seen an improvement in the first half cash conversion ratio, up to 69% from last year's 62%. We still have the target for the year of 90%-95%, but with the weighting into the second half of the year, that's where it came from. So last year, we were just shy of that, about 88% for the full year. But the next chart really shows the sawtooth that we now have in terms of first half, second half, cash conversion and working capital movements, really driven by when we have our deferred, when we have our renewals around maintenance. The third quarter for us, leading up to December and January, is when a lot of renewals happen. A lot of the companies that we've acquired over the years, traditionally sort of December year-end type companies, and obviously companies generally budget around that period, so that's where you get that peak. And in terms of quantum, the next chart just shows those working capital movements in a bit more detail, so you can see that. One point to note, we've had a slight tick up in terms of our DSO, days sales outstanding. That's primarily driven by Serena, which is slightly higher in terms of its DSO, the rest of the group. We're driving that more towards group levels over time, so we'd hope to bring that back down in the second half of the year. Cash generated from operations chart, we've brought this up from the back just so you can see it. And really, the numbers I'd like you to focus on this chart are the bottom. And last year, we had 163 million cash generated from operations. Now we're over 200 in the period. You can see the full year number of  456. So in the second half of last year, 162 in the first, 293 in the second. So very strong second half performance from a cash flow generated from operations. A bit more here in terms of the detail. We've had a benefit this time round in terms of cash paid out. So last year, we were paid out about 47 million. This year, it's only 18 million in the first half of the year, so that's clearly benefiting us. But some other cash flows further down, clearly the financing outflows, reasonably big impact, the dividend being up compared to last year as we increased that final dividend of the year from 70 million up to 111 million. But overall, flat net debt first half when you take into account the Serena transaction. Profitability by portfolio, just illustrating, you've seen these numbers from Niels and Stephen, but this is the overall group position, how it flows out, and the improvement we've seen on a pro forma basis, that uptick of 6.2% on the underlying adjusted EBITDA. And then in terms of the adjusted operating cost, this chart just gives you the breakdown of where those three things that we adjust our performance measures for, being amortization of purchase intangibles, share-based compensation, and the exceptional items, where they fall in each of the lines on the P&L so that you've got that as a reference point. Currency, we obviously do restate the numbers of the previous year to the exchange rates we've experienced. Biggest change you would probably think was around Brexit and the weakening of sterling against the dollar. That clearly has a benefit for us because we only have about 5% of our revenue and 13% of our cost denominated in sterling. So that's a positive from a profit point of view. The one that you may not have picked up on is just the strengthening of the yen against the dollar. Clearly, that offsets it because we've got, yes, 3.5% of our revenue, only 1.8% of our cost. So actually, from a reported basis, that has a negative impact on profit. Where does that put us overall? Again, taking the pro forma numbers, this is a chart you'll recognize from the prelims in terms of breaking this down. But we take Micro Focus, we take Serena as reported, we then adjust for the currency. It really makes very little difference. And so in looking at that improvement over the year, it's the 615.4 that we're trying to improve kind of year on year from a management point of view. Breakdown here in terms of the revenue between the two portfolios. And the growth in SUSE, you can see that as you go from the half 1.15 to half 1.16, we've included Serena in there for those numbers as well. You can just see the chunks in terms of changes in the revenue profile. So I'll just point you to that in terms of a set of numbers. And here it is breaking it down between the component parts, license, maintenance, consultancy, and the subscription revenues. So you've got that as a reference point as well. Exceptional items in the first half of the year. Clearly, we were continuing to undertake integration activity. We also started to consolidate in terms of management on the Serena business, so we had some exceptionals there. But clearly, a large element there was related to HPE. The HPE transaction is the first cross-border reverse Morris Trust that has ever been done. Every advisor that we speak to tells us how complicated it is and how nobody's ever done this before. So from that point of view, quite interesting and challenging. What we're now doing is giving you an idea of where we see the costs as we prepare for that integration and a completion in Q3 of next year. Just giving you an indication of what we may spend in the second half of the year and then up to completion. We haven't provided you with those numbers before. This is our first opportunity to do it. Clearly, we'll look to spend less if we can. Clearly, we won't scrimp and save because what we're doing is very complicated and we want it to be very successful. And it's really a question of where we're going to end up rather than necessarily how much it might cost us to get there through this process. You'd be reminded, of course, that in separating out the software business, HPE are calling out a cost of something like $700 million in order to do it. Clearly, we've got to prepare for landing that, and so we've got some costs related to it which are exceptional in nature. On the balance sheet, you can see the movement in the goodwill arising out of the Serena transaction that we had in the period. Nothing of real note otherwise, but just the summary balance sheet there for you to consider. And my last two slides, and only two slides this time around on tax. So just looking at the effective tax rate that we've experienced in the first half of the year, and then a little bit of explanation in terms of clearly we've got some disallowable costs on a reported basis related to the HPE transaction, so that bumps it up on a reported basis. Once you adjust, actually, it's in the range that we gave of 23 to 27. There is an impact of the ongoing work around the OECD's BEPS initiative. And the other key point I've already mentioned in terms of the cash tax in the period reducing. So, as I said, all of our usual charts in the back of the appendix, but hopefully that's a quick run on the finances. And I'll hand over to Kevin to run us through on the summary.
Thanks, Mike. Good morning, everybody. I'll try and be brief so we get time for questions. Just a few questions that people have said in advance they're interested in. Are the acquisitions delivering? We can't tell you a lot about the HPE stuff because it's not public domain, but if you look back to TAG, Stephen showed you headcount reduction, property reduction. Those are indicative of the kinds of things that we would look to do. This is also a chart that we showed to some of the HPE directors during the purchase process, as this was back in August. And it was to answer the question of, do you guys increase your EBITDA just by buying things, or do you actually improve them once you've bought them? Now, this gives them an indication, and it shows 34% of 490 million improvement in EBITDA coming from operational improvements. Now, that actually understates it, because as you'll recall, some of our acquisitions, revenue goes down, because we don't care about revenue growth. And so if you actually took out the revenue declines, which were funded by further incremental improvements, you get a lot more than this. But it's just to give you a feel for the kind of things that can be achieved. Lots of questions about the HPE transaction. We remain constricted in the sense that we can't give you any public information about that business that they choose not to put in the public domain because they're a listed company. What we can say is that we continue to believe that from a product perspective, it makes strategic sense. There's strategic sense in the product alignments. Financially, the numbers are compelling when you work through the numbers. It creates a bigger business in the infrastructure space. It'll be one of the largest in the world, which gives great opportunities for our employees and clearly substantial returns to shareholders. We, in the announcement, talked about improving a percentage of the business by a certain percentage. Broadly speaking, it's designed to get you to roughly 600 million of EBITDA improvement in the medium term, which takes us to about 2 billion, is where the math should come out. And as you know, we normally give guidance, which we think we can make. We don't tend to give guidance that we can't make. The HP software year-end results were out a couple of weeks ago. They were in line with our expectations, so no surprises there. The spin-off and merger plans are running to schedule. As Mike said, there's lots of things to do. Complicated in the sense there are lots of things to do, but individually, most of them have done before. We have started meeting HPE shareholders. We met every HPE shareholder on the East Coast who has more than a million shares when we were there a few weeks ago, and we're doing the same on the West Coast in January. Most of them are at the stage where they're either already MicroFocus holders, and so they know the story, or they're in the situation where it's micro who, and we're starting explaining them from scratch. They're all in the process of building models. They know they've got through to third quarter next year to come to their conclusion. But I think the response we're seeing so far is that most people actually very quickly draw comparisons between people who try and say they're going to grow mature businesses and people who don't, and the returns, and they actually seem to get it. By definition, most of the HPE current holders are at the value end of the scale because of the transformation that HP are going in. So they are people who are receptive to the kind of messaging that we're talking about. And we continue to be encouraged by the strength as we meet more people across the software business, the strength of management within that business, which is encouraging. This is the broad transaction timetable. Key date is circular in May, shareholder vote in May, closing in the third quarter. You're used to seeing us put out four-year plans. We did it in 2011. We did it in 2014. This is the plan for HPE. It's the same. And then in 2020, we'll do it again. There'll be some other four-year plan for something by then.
This is the combined business overview, and this was in the announcement charts.
But again, just reiterating the amount of the business which is recurring revenue, either in subscriptions or in maintenance. And the bottom right-hand corner gives you a broad breakdown of where the portfolio comes from. But as Stephen made the point in the MicroFocus portfolio, because you're looking at mature assets, often the numbers will be up and down on individual periods. If you dug down below any of those categories in MicroFocus to the next layer, you'll find products in the period with growth rates of over 50%. You'll find products with decline rates of over 50%. And they will move from period to period because it's a mature space. There is no white space. That will be compounded when we get to HP. There will be a broader portfolio of products, and very few of them will overall, as individual products, trend. Something like SUSE, where there's growth, you can see trend lines and you can measure it. The rest of it will be a portfolio. So it's going to be an interesting challenge for people to get their heads around. The bigger the portfolio, the bigger the smoothing effect, though. So at a macro level, it actually becomes easier to manage. Our strategy, effectively, nothing's changed. You'll be used to the idea that every time we present, the strategy chart says it's the same. This one, credit to James at Barclays, who's let us steal his chart. James went through could he build the MicroFocus family tree? And on here, he's put companies that have been acquired by companies that we've acquired. There are some that are missing, and one of the things we'll look to do is to fill it out. The reason I put it up is it's an interesting question that often puzzles the US investors. How does this little unknown company from Berkshire in the UK that started with COBOL development tools end up owning all these iconic names from the history of IT for the last 30 years? And the simple answer is because every one of those other companies has made the wrong strategic decisions and destroyed value. Because otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to afford to buy them. If you do the add up of all the, what James has put in here is the prices that people paid for companies. If you do the add up of that chart and you say, how again did we get that? Because we didn't pay that much for all these things when we bought them. It's because people have made the wrong strategic choices. From a customer perspective, it's really interesting because if you're a big customer and you've got lots of mature infrastructure software, is your mature infrastructure software being provided to you by someone who's going to be around to be with you for the next 10, 15, 20 years of its useful life? Or is that company going to be bought by someone else? So what we're building is a company that will be there for the customers over that period of time. because our strategy works and it's sustainable. And most of the other companies out there don't have sustainable strategies, because if they did, they'd still be independent. So it's quite an interesting strategic thing to ponder as you go forward, and the implications of it going forward. The other thing one investor asked us to do, and I'm not sure we're brave enough to do it, is to, for every one of those companies, work out what their peak market cap was at some point. So I guess Novell at one point was worth 100 billion, and Borland was probably similar, but we'll see. So our outlook for the year, double-digit shareholder returns, why change? We're not going to change the revenue guidance for the year again, why change? We are building a base for a modest revenue growth from our business going forward. And then, of course, we'll then be laying on the HPE piece. And we're going to keep to our policy of 2.5 times debt to EBITDA and returning capital beyond that. So that will turn over to questions.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm conscious we're running a little bit late. We will flow through a few minutes over the hour to make sure we give sufficient time for questions. If some of you have got a hard stop on the hour, then please just do step away. Totally understand. For the questions, we are recording this, so if you would be polite enough to indicate if you've got a question, and we'll get a microphone to you so that people who listen to this later can hear your question. And please, if you could start with one question each so we can get round as many as possible, that would be good. Michael.
Great, thank you. Mike, in terms of the exceptional cost, there's 80 million this year and 60 million pre-acquisition. Can you talk a bit about what that's related to and the cash flow effect? When you talk of 90-95% conversion, is that after the exceptional cash costs? And then, just a very quick one on finance cost. Have you got any sense on the cost of debt that you will have to pay? Obviously, the Fed's meeting today, and rates seem to be going up, not down.
Oh, well, it's quite interesting. You'll recall that we did a repricing of our debt in August and got a benefit in terms of the debt. That put in place a six-month soft call premium so that we can't go out and reprice it again. Debt's currently trading at 101, which would suggest that the yield that is being achieved on that is lower than it was in August at the time that people bought into it. So it's interesting to see where the market thinks that the debt's going. In terms of the announcement, we've said what we expect the financing cost to be in terms of the debt raise cost. We haven't at the moment said what we think the cost ongoing is going to be, but as I said, if the current debt is trading above its par value, then that would indicate that people are viewing us as a reasonably good instrument to trade in. In terms of the cash conversion, the consistent cash conversion measure that we've had takes the cash flow generated from operations and divides it by adjusted EBITDA less exceptionals. So the exceptional costs are taken into account, although you may have a movement between periods as to when you've taken the provision and when the cash flows out of that. And in terms of the exceptionals, effectively we've got two things running. One is the costs of doing the deal. So you can see that we're doing SEC filings, we're doing UKLA filings, we're converting US GAAP financials into IFRS, and reporting on those, the usual working capital that goes with all of that. So there's the advisor's fees related to it. There's also the advisor's fees related to, okay, there's a structure coming over from a tax perspective. How do we fit that into a UK environment as opposed to a US environment? So we're taking advice in terms of how we manage that to get the most effective tax rate we can going forward. What we've also then got are integration costs related to, we've got something that we're going to be taking on in terms of a, you know, something that's 2 and a bit times our size. How do we integrate that into what we're doing? What are we going to be getting? And therefore, what we've asked for each of the work streams involved in the project, what costs do you see incurring between now and completion in terms of integrating the business? And those could be external costs in terms of additional heads. It could be additional software that we need, so a consolidation module that we'll need to put on top of their systems and ours to make sure that we can report on time. So those are the things that are included in the second half, 80 million, and up to completion of 60. And what we wanted to do was give you an idea of the up to number that we might be incurring. And clearly we're going to look to spend less, but we're not going to spend less at the risk of not being able to integrate it in the way that we want to.
Charlie.
Hi, it's Charlie Brennan from Credit Suisse. Just as a clarity question on the exceptionals, is that 80 million for the full year or 80 million for the second half?
80 million for the second half.
And then can you just try and help me understand what's driving the profits growth you've experienced in the period? I think the exceptional costs relating to Serena might be slightly higher than I was expecting. I didn't realize you were doing much to that. Can you identify what the cost savings you achieved in the period were relating to Serena? And secondly, maybe you can do that with Attachmate. You were executing cost rationalization plans through last year. What's the annualized benefit of that you've had in the first half of this year? Thanks.
In terms of the Serena costs, primarily what we've done is taken out the three key guys at the top. And it was quite expensive. Because shortly before they sold the business, they put in place long-term contracts that we had no choice but to pay out. So we've taken the three most expensive people out of that business, and the cost saving is broadly what we've spent on it. So that's the side of it. In terms of what's driving the improvement in profitability, it's the fact that we look at the business each year that we plan it, and we look at the anticipated revenues, and you put in a cost base that can support that anticipated revenue. So from the SUSE size of the house, the challenge we gave to Niels 2 years ago as we went through the planning process was, we want you to grow faster than Red Hat. And we will invest in the business through that process while you grow faster than Red Hat. And each year we've increased the investment we've put into that portfolio. This period, Niels has grown faster than Red Hat. So we'll continue to look at that. We're now bringing that margin down with the acquisitions that we're making around OpenAttic and also around the HPE assets, because actually that's going to drive the next wave of growth, and you need to invest ahead of that. So the margin in SUSE will come down as we make those investments. In terms of Attachmate, how much did we save out of Attachmate? Attachmate didn't exist from the 1st of May 2015. It became part of Stephen's business. And what we look at then, again, is what are the trends in revenue? What is it that you can afford in order to support that? And what we look to do is drive improvement in the underlying adjusted EBITDA. So one analyst said to me at the time that we acquired Serena, he said, oh, well, you've done your profit growth for next year because you've included, you've got Serena, you've got 80 million plus whatever you can get out of it. And I said, it doesn't quite work that way. We've got a very tough chairwoman of the remuneration committee who, you know, wanted us to pro forma the numbers in. So we've got to take the 80 million they delivered last year and improve on that. And that's what we do in looking at combining the business. So you can't come down to a specific, how much did you save out of the Attachmate acquisition? It's how do you drive the ongoing performance of the business?
But we can get some specifics on Serena. What was the exceptional cost?
About 4 million.
Yeah, I put another lens on it because.
I mean, to go to probably where you're headed, when we do our acquisition appraisal, we include all cash costs that we foresee going forward, whether they're exceptional or non-exceptional, in the IRR calculations. So it's quite common when you buy a US company, as Mike said, that they will have put conditions in around employees where, for instance, in the case of TAG on closure, all stock schemes, all bonus schemes, all accelerated, plus bonuses on doing the completion. Now, when we see those, we actually put that cash cost in our calculation of the IRR when we're doing our acquisition accounting. Because clearly it would be false to say we can do an acquisition, it's all great, but we'll ignore all the exceptional costs, because you can't. So at that point, when we looked at HPE, we've built all those costs, all the exceptional costs into the business model and the cash case, so that on doing that calculation, we can see it's a good return.
But you do get, with US companies, some fairly staggering amounts paid to departing executives, which no one would regard as a normal transaction. There were people in Attachmate paid over $40 million on exiting. Individuals.
And just a very quick detail follow-up, if I can. Can you just remind me, when you bought Attachmate, there was a deferred revenue write-off that negatively impacted revenues to begin with. What does the rebuild of deferred revenue mean for the revenue benefit in this period?
This period, it was relatively small in terms of the impact of deferred revenue haircuts. So back in 2015, we took in the first year, well, it was October, November we completed, so on completion we took about 6%. That unwound 17 million in the first 5 months, 17 million in the following year, down to about 6 or 7 in FY16. So this year it's about 3.4. On Serena, we're taking a similar deferred revenue haircut when we get to HPE transaction. You'll have a similar level in terms of deferred revenue haircut, and heaven forbid if we go to the US GAAP approach, and it'll be about 55%.
I have another question. David. Hold on, David.
Sorry. David Thompson from Numis. If we look at TAG, you had about a four-month period of appraising the business before you did much with them post-acquisition. You talked initially with HPE about a sort of measured approach post-acquisition, post-completion. But if you look at these exceptional charges and all the integration work you're doing, it would appear that you're going to be in a position to hit the ground running somewhat faster than that. So are you really going to drop $140 million on planning and then sit there and do nothing for 4 months? Or does that $140 million mean day one, week one, that you can actually start taking actions?
Well, you're restricted in terms of what you can do day one. So in terms of the integration planning, there's a whole clean room exercise that's gone through in terms of who can look at certain data, because you can't go through gun jumping. The difference, as you quite rightly pointed out, at the time we announced, we pretty much had the prospectus done on Attachmate. We completed. We had a year-end coming up for them at the end of March, year-end coming up for us the end of April. The integration work streams started work from completion. And determined what the structure was going to be. Clearly, we've got a much longer runway here, and we would like to get to a position that we can do things earlier rather than later. But you have to be cognizant of not gun jumping.
And again, in terms of process, I mean, it's fascinating. We had a meeting last week with some of the key executives in the Hewlett-Packard software business. There was an outside consultant who'd done some preparation work for that meeting, and it's looking at plans of how you would integrate. They had to put all that work through a legal review before the charts could be shown in the meeting because of gun jumping regulations. And they go through the charts and certain things get taken off the charts. So there's certain information that the consultant has, because they've collected from both companies, that neither company is allowed to see. The minutes of the meeting have to be reviewed by lawyers before they can be published. And those are all costs which in the end go into this kind of thing. Now, until you've actually done this kind of exercise, most people would be totally oblivious to the fact you would even think about having the minutes of a meeting reviewed by a lawyer before you can publish the minutes of the meeting. But SEC regulations are pretty strict, and the worst thing we could do is to actually break any of those regulations. So while some of the numbers look quite big, when you actually, and actually maybe for education, if anyone's interested, go and talk to one of the banking on the broker side, and ask them the cost of doing things like gap IFRS conversions or whatever. There is an industry out there in helping people do these things, and you have to do some of it. I think most of the advisors would then accuse us of being tight, and that I think most people who've worked with us would say that we are actually very mean in terms of the fees we pay, and yet even being mean, you get to these kind of numbers.
Stacey.
Thanks. Given the stronger start to the year, why not raise the full year guidance just a little bit? And then if I can break that down on the SUSE, what kind of growth are you anticipating in the order book in the second half? And then on the Micro Focus portfolio, mixed performance across different product sets. How much visibility do you have, or do you think you have in license and consulting for those streams?
No. Well, because it's a portfolio, we've got a pretty good lens on how things are trending at the higher level, so we can do quite a reasonable amount of confidence around, you know, the trend levels. And then you just check and underpin that with pipeline, transaction volume, deals to understand whether there's anything that would be counter trend. You know, and that allows you the basis to predict whether you need to be running your cost base tighter because you've got potentially some revenue headwinds, or, you know, whether you can actually push ahead with some of the things you want to invest in. So it's no rocket science to it, Stacey. We just work through it.
Stream by stream, 3 or 6 months visibility, or
It varies. So where the transactions are lumpier and bigger, you've probably got it more like a 6 months. And then the question is, when can you get them done? Where the transactions are more volume and more run rate, then it's shorter and it's more trend.
So from a SUSE perspective, so I think you pointed to the performance in the first half of the year and why that should not maybe tell us what the performance in the second half of the year is. So I honestly believe that there were certain things happening in our favor in the first half of the year, especially in international, that we should not expect to repeat in the exact same way. So if you saw some of that extraordinary, exceptional performance, so then I would not expect to see that exact same exceptional performance in the second half of the year. However, we have a clear growth plan and strategy and commitment to grow the business ahead of the market rate. And now you have to debate on what the market rate is, and there's different pieces of information in the market. If you look to companies like IDC or Gartner, who follow the paid enterprise Linux market, then their prediction from April of this year was that the market will grow roughly in the area of 14% for the next 3 years annually. At the same time, you have to notice that now we published our numbers and we are way ahead of that growth rate. And then the other big player in the market also published their numbers, and their infrastructure business on the Linux side is also ahead of Gartner's and IDC's growth rate. So now you might wonder yourself, well, if the two companies that own most of the market share are growing faster than what the analysts predict, so who is really right? So, and I would suggest, if I might offer an opinion, that probably the truth is somewhere in the middle, okay? And my commitment is that I will want to beat that market performance. So it definitely has to be north of 14%, but it will probably be south of the 23% that we saw in the first half of the year, okay? And that will reflect both in the bookings performance. You specifically asked about billings. We have pipeline visibility, so I'm confident about meeting those billings objectives. And that will then ultimately transpire also in the right revenue growth that we need to do. Okay. So we will beat market trends. That's what we will do.
And on the overall number, if we get to the point where we're convinced we're going to beat the guidance, then we'll announce it. And if we don't get to that point, why take the risk? But you'd need a pretty bad second half to get to the bottom end of the guidance.
Okay, we'll take one more question, and then George, actually down at the front here. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, George O'Connor. Can you tell us, please, what metrics you use to judge the effectiveness of R&D? Is this applied equally at divisional level? And should I think of something like proportion of license revenue from products introduced in the past couple of years?
So there's clearly an overall investment level at the product group. We're in a single product group rather than divisional BUs that then have this idea of resource conflict inherently built in. So as Mike explained earlier, we look at what we think the revenue trend for the business is. We then look at the cost base that can support the EBITDA, and then we assign budgets behind that. Then the product group within there run a really formal process where they do 3-year product plans with 1-year business plans, which have a whole range of metrics in it, including release cadence, content of releases. That gets reviewed up the management line, ends up with me, and we prioritize within that cost envelope at the product level.
So it's really driven by that overall macro level cost base, and then prioritization at a very granular level underneath that, George.
And percent of revenue from products?
Well, I would struggle to define for you a new product. So when I introduce a new capability in COBOL, for example, I may package it in a release that has chargeable elements for the customer, or I may make it a maintenance entitlement for those on maintenance. So, we produce very few completely new products, yeah, which is where that metric would typically be a very relevant metric.
Okay. Thank you all for your patience. Appreciate that we've kept you a little bit longer. Dan, if you'd like to terminate the recording now, that would be great.